The corner of Industrial Terrace and Marcus Garvey Drive is not a place that appears in any history book. It is a strip of Kingston asphalt, unremarkable, functional, loud with the sound of passing traffic, and yet on the night of February 4th, 1979, it became the place where Jamaica's last chance at peace was executed by the side of the road and left to bleed out in the dark. The police report would say that Claude Massop had a gun. It would say he fired first. It would say the 40-plus bullets that tore through his body were a matter of officers defending themselves under lawful authority. The witness, who stood near enough to see what actually happened, told a different story to the Jamaica Gleaner, a story of a vehicle that was blocked, men who were searched, and then men who were killed. In December of 1982, four officers stood trial for the murder of Claude Massop. All four were acquitted. The gun that Massop allegedly fired was never recovered by any independent investigation, never confirmed by any neutral witness, never established as real by any proceeding that produced a conviction. It existed only in the official record, and in Jamaica in 1979. That meant it existed exactly where the people who needed it to exist had decided to put it. To understand why that gun had to exist, why a man the state had protected for 15 years had to be transformed on one February night into a threat requiring 40 bullets, you have to go back to a Kingston that no longer exists. Back to the raw, heat-soaked, zinc-roofed tenement yards of the late 1940s, to a community still called Bacco Wall, to the urban poor who crowded the western edge of the city and understood from birth that Jamaica had been built in their image and not for their benefit. Claude Massop was born on May 12, 1947, in West Kingston's Denham Town, a neighborhood that announced with every crumbling wall and open drain the precise distance between Jamaica's post-colonial promise and its everyday reality. His early years are not documented in the way that powerful men's early years are usually documented. There are no published interviews, no school records in the press, no family narratives preserved by journalists who arrived too late. What is known is what he became, and how fast he became it. By the time he was 18 years old, 1965, Massop was already the acknowledged leader of what would later be renamed the Shower Posse, a gang rooted in the emerging housing projects of West Kingston that were just beginning, under the architectural ambition of a politician named Edward Siga, to be called Tivoli Gardens. Siga had arrived in West Kingston in 1961 as the Jamaica Labour Party's candidate for the constituency. A Boston-born Harvard anthropologist with a Lebanese-Syrian family background and an almost forensic understanding of how to bind poor Jamaican communities to a political patron. He had studied the culture of the African poor with academic intensity, documented their religious practices, produced their music through his own record label, and built enough institutional loyalty in West Kingston to win the seat. He had also recognized, with the cold pragmatism of a man who had grown up adjacent to power without fully possessing it, that a community dependent on you for its physical existence, for its housing, its utilities, its community center, its football club, was a community that would vote for you and, when necessary, fight for you, without requiring much additional persuasion. Bacco Wall, the overcrowded ghetto that occupied the land before Tivoli Gardens was built, was demolished in 1963. Thousands of poor residents, many of them Rastafari, many of them PNP-aligned, were cleared off the land by government bulldozers. In their place, Siega built Tivoli Gardens, a structured housing project with proper units, proper roads, a community that could be named, organized, and crucially controlled. The people who moved in were vetted. As the years passed and the political temperature of Kingston rose, Tivoli Gardens became something more specific than a neighborhood. It became a garrison, a space of near-total political homogeneity, where loyalty to the JLP was not a preference, but a condition of residency, and where violent enforcers ensured that anyone with PNP sympathies understood they were not welcome. Claude Massop was the man who enforced that condition. His authority was not built on violence alone, though violence was always its foundation and its guarantee. He governed Tivoli Gardens the way a mayor governs a city, settling disputes, dispensing patronage, controlling economic activity, providing the kind of order that a state too distant and too indifferent to reach into a garrison community could never offer. When someone's rent was overdue, when a family was threatened from outside the community, when a young man was caught stealing from a neighbor, it was Massup they came to. He was judge, protector, and executioner in a system the Jamaican government had not built and would not dismantle because it was too useful. The Don filled the vacuum the state had deliberately left open. His rivals understood exactly what he was, because they were the same thing on the other side of the line. By 1967, Massop's principal opponents were operating out of Arnett Gardens, the PNP-aligned garrison, just across the invisible but blood-soaked boundary that divided West Kingston's political geography. It was known as Jungle, and from its concrete yards came George Feathermop Spence, Winston Berryboy Blake, and their lieutenant Anthony Welch. Blake and Spence led a motorcycle gang that would operate for nearly 10 years, from 1967 to 1976, enforcing the PNP's grip on Arnett Gardens with the same methods Massop used in Tivoli, terrorizing residents of Rema and the surrounding areas, delivering loyalty through the systematic application of fear. They were political instruments of Anthony Spaulding, the PNP's housing minister, men who did for the PNP in West Kingston what Massup did for the JLP. The machinery on both sides was identical. Only the colors were different. And then there was Aston Bucky Marshall Thompson of Matthews Lane. Marshall was older than the motorcycle gang enforcers, more strategically minded, more specifically dangerous. He was the PNP's chief enforcer in Central Kingston, feared across the political divide, connected directly to the party's leadership, and in every meaningful sense the man most equivalent to Massop in the landscape of West Kingston's underworld. Their conflict was not personal at its root. It was structural. They were instruments pointed at each other by men who would never stand in the crossfire, firing on behalf of a political system that required their violence to maintain the garrison order and then required their silence about who had authorized it. Throughout the late 1960s and into the 1970s, Massop accumulated arrests the way other men accumulate job titles. Murder, armed robbery, perjury, shooting with intent, illegal possession of firearms. Not one charge produced a conviction. He was too embedded, too useful, too deeply woven into the political infrastructure of West Kingston for the legal system to hold him. When police came for him, the charges dissolved. When courts received the cases, the witnesses disappeared. This was not coincidence. This was the architecture of garrison politics operating as designed, protecting its instruments until they became inconvenient. The 1976 general election arrived in Jamaica like a detonation. Michael Manley's PNP was defending its government against Edward Sega's JLP in the most ideologically charged contest in the island's independent history, and the garrison communities were burning. Weapons had been flowing into West Kingston for years through channels that the Pambazuka Academic Analysis and the Kerry Senate Committee's 1989 testimony would later connect to Cold War intelligence operations, the CIA working to destabilize Manley's democratic socialist government, using political enforcers like Massop as instruments in a proxy conflict that would not have looked out of place in Guatemala or Chile. More than 800 deaths were ultimately recorded between the two political factions by the time the 1980 elections concluded. The rivers that ran between Tivoli Gardens and Arnett Gardens ran with neighborhood blood on behalf of men who never walked those streets after dark. In December 1976, days after the PNP won re-election with 57% of the vote in the highest turnout election in Jamaican history, Bob Marley was shot at his Hope Road home in what remains one of the most contested events in Jamaica's modern history. Two gunmen entered the compound during a rehearsal for the Free Smile Jamaica concert. Marley was performing at Manley's request. Marley was wounded. His wife Rita was shot in the head. His manager, Don Taylor, was shot multiple times. The gunman escaped. Their identities, their precise affiliations, their chain of command, the full political logic of the attack, remain disputed to this day, layered under decades of competing claims, deliberate silence, and tactical misdirection. Massop's name circulated in the aftermath, not as a confirmed participant, but as a figure some accounts placed in proximity to the warning that was or wasn't passed in time. The truth of that December night has never been established to the standard that courts require. What is established is what happened next. Massop was detained in the state of emergency Manly, declared after the election. He was released in January 1977 and walked directly back to Tivoli Gardens, 30 years old, his power intact, his charges evaporated, his community waiting for him exactly where he had left it. What happened inside a Kingston lockup sometime in the mid-1970s? The specific detail that nobody wrote down, nobody officially recorded, the thing that passed between two dangerous men in a cell they were not supposed to share, would change the course of Jamaican history more decisively than any election, any American covert operation, or any quantity of weapons flowing through the garrison pipelines. Claude Massop and Bucky Marshall were placed in the same jail cell, two men who had spent years on opposite sides of a war neither of them had started, who had watched their communities bury children in the name of a political contest being fought by men who slept safely every night in houses far from the shooting, found themselves with nothing between them but time and the particular honesty that confinement sometimes forces on people who have been performing roles their entire adult lives. What they said to each other is not in any court record. What emerged from it is documented in two sources that agree completely, the One Love Peace Concert itself and everything that followed. Both men arrived at the same conclusion. The violence was consuming their communities. It was not protecting them, not advancing them, not delivering any material benefit to the people of West Kingston, who bled for it election after election. It was hollowing them out, funeral by funeral, year by year, while the politicians it served remained untouched and unmoved. The garrison system needed the conflict to function. It needed the Dons to remain locked in war, because a Don at war was a Don who depended on political backing and would not threaten the arrangement that had created him. A Don at peace was something the system had no category for. A Don at peace was a liability. Massop and Marshall began building the peace from inside the cell. In January 1978, following his release, Bucky Marshall was free. The first thing he did was find Massop. That evening, at the corner of Oxford and Beeston Streets, the official line of demarcation between their two communities, something that should have been logistically and politically impossible, occurred. The candles came out. The guns went down. The men from Matthews Lane and the men from Tivoli Gardens stood in the dark at the boundary of their war and stopped shooting. But both men understood, with the tactical intelligence of people who had operated inside complex power structures their entire lives, that a street-level truce was perishable. It needed weight. It needed visibility. It needed a witness whose moral authority was recognized, not just in West Kingston, but across the entire island and beyond it, someone whose presence could transform a local ceasefire into a national event that could not easily be walked back. There was only one person in the world who could do that. Massop flew to London. Bob Marley was living in exile in the English winter, still recovering 18 months after the shooting, composing the music that would become Exodus and Kaya, processing the knowledge that his country had tried to kill him and that the men who had built that country's political violence were now asking him to come home and help undo it. He and Massop knew each other from the old days, from the concrete yards of Trenchtown, from the pickup football and the early reggae culture of West Kingston before the political garrisons had fully calcified, from a time when the men who would become famous and the men who would become feared were still just young men from the same streets navigating the same poverty together. The connection was not ideological. It was geographic and human and older than politics. Massop made his case. Marley listened, and then Marley came home. April 22, 1978. It is 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and the National Stadium in Kingston is filling with more than 32,000 people. The sky above the stadium holds the last heat of the Jamaican April day, and the stage at the center of the field is ringed with sound equipment for 16 of reggae's biggest acts, a lineup assembled specifically because two men who had spent years trying to kill each other's communities had decided in a jail cell that music was the only thing powerful enough to make the peace real. Asfaw Wasson, the crown prince of Ethiopia, sends a message that opens the proceedings. The Rastafari movement breathes through every corner of the night. Jacob Miller takes the stage for Inner Circle and lights the second half of the concert with an energy that feels specifically Jamaican, volatile, joyful, dangerous, and alive. Edward Seeger arrives and takes his seat. Michael Manley takes his seat beside him. Peter Tosh performs for 66 minutes, spending nearly half of that time looking directly at both politicians and condemning them, publicly and specifically, for their positions on marijuana legalization and political violence, an act of public accountability that would have been unthinkable on any other stage in any other context in Jamaican political life. Then Bob Marley takes the stage at 12:30 in the morning. He plays Lion of Judah. He plays Natural Mystic. He plays Trenchtown Rock and Natty Dread. The crowd is enormous and alive, and the night has already been historic before he reaches jammin'. And then, somewhere in the improvisational middle of that performance, Marley stops the music and speaks directly to the people in front of him, to the tens of thousands in the stadium, to the island listening on radio, to the politicians sitting in the front rows who had not been told what was coming. "I'm not so good at talking," Marley says, "but I hope you understand what I'm trying to say. Could we have up here on stage the presence of Mr. Michael Manley and Mr. Edward Sega? I just want to shake hands and show the people that we're going to make it right. We're going to unite." Both men come to the stage. Marley is small. Manley towers over him on one side, Sega on the other. And this man, this small, dreadlocked man, who had been shot in his own house and survived, who had left Jamaica because it was trying to destroy him, who had come back because two gangsters asked him to bresh, raises the hands of the two most powerful politicians in Jamaica above his own head and holds them there while the crowd erupts. Claude Masope stands in the wings watching this. He had organized it. He had flown to London for it. He had called the ceasefire, planted the candles, built the coalition across the most lethal political boundary in Jamaican public life, and now he watches Bob Marley hold up the hands of Edward Saga and Michael Manley in front of 32,000 witnesses while the stadium roars loud enough to shake the concrete beneath their feet. For a moment, for exactly the length of time it took for that image to burn itself into everyone present, Jamaica was completely at peace. The peace moved fast through the garrison communities in the weeks that followed. Not completely, not everywhere, not without fractures and setbacks and old grievances threatening to resurface, but in ways that hadn't been seen in years, the gun politics of Kingston quieted. Masop was working it from the JLP side, Marshall from the PNP side, both men moving through their communities with the authority of men who had been inside the machine long enough to know which levers actually moved it. They needed the peace to mean something material. They needed the politicians to deliver what they had always promised on stages and never provided in practice: jobs, services, genuine investment in the communities that their political enforcers had been burning down for a decade. The ghost of that unrecovered gun, the question of what weapons had been flowing into Tivoli Gardens and through exactly whose hands and whose strategic interests they had been serving, had never gone away. It had only gone quiet, buried beneath the noise of the peace concert and the hope it generated. But the men who had supplied those weapons were still in their offices. The system that required the garrisons to remain armed and loyal was still running. And a peace that put Masop and Marshall in business for themselves, building coalitions, making demands, organizing communities in ways that didn't require permission from the politicians who had created them, was not a piece that served the architects of the garrison order. The politicians had never needed peace. They had needed the Dons to remain useful. A Don who governed a garrison and delivered votes was an asset. A Don who called a peace concert, flew to London, built a cross-party coalition, and began demonstrating that the garrison communities could organize themselves independently, was something else entirely. He was a man who had started to understand the system from the outside, and men who understood the system from the outside did not survive it. 9 months after the peace concert, at the corner of Industrial Terrace and Marcus Garvey Drive, the calculation is made visible. It is the evening of February 4th, 1979. Massop has spent the day in Spanish Town watching the Tivoli Gardens Football Club, the very football club whose existence was a small concrete emblem of the community building he had been doing since before he could vote. He is in a blue and white Morris Oxford, license plate NE4800. In the car with him are Lloyd Fraser, 21 years old, listed in records as a racehorse trainer from a Tivoli Gardens address, and Alphonson Trevor Tinson, a Jamaican living in Canada. The police moved to block the vehicle. The official account states that Massop exited the car and fired 2 shots at the officers. The officers returned fire in self-defense. That is the record. It is the record that 4 officers used in their defense at a murder trial 3 years later. It is the record that produced 4 acquittals in December 1982. A witness present at the scene gave the Jamaica Gleaner a different account entirely. A vehicle blocked, men searched, men killed without provocation, no weapon produced by the men who were shot. What is not in dispute is the count. Claude Massop is shot more than 40 times. Lloyd Fraser is shot dead. Alphonson Trevor Tinson is shot dead. 2 other occupants escape. The gun that allegedly justified all of this is never independently recovered, never confirmed by any neutral party, never established in any proceeding that found anyone guilty of anything. The 40 bullets were not self-defense. They were a statement about what happened to Dons who stopped being useful, a statement about the cost of independence, a statement addressed specifically to anyone else in the garrison system who might be considering, in the months before an election year, that the peace might be worth continuing. 15,000 people attended Claude Massop's funeral in West Kingston. They came from Tivoli Gardens and from the surrounding blocks and from communities across Kingston that had feared his name and needed his protection and understood, with the bone-deep clarity of people who had lived inside the garrison system every day of their lives, exactly what his death meant. Bucky Marshall read the same message and fled to Canada. He had correctly identified the pattern. It did not save him. In March 1980, inside a New York City nightclub, Marshall was shot and killed. Both men who had built the One Love Peace concert were dead within 2 years of the night they stood on that stage together. The year 1980 arrived in Jamaica, soaked in blood. The general election held on October 30th recorded 844 murders by official police statistics, a figure that political analysts of the period believed was artificially low, given the challenges of recording criminal activity inside garrison communities, where reporting was neither safe nor simple. The West Central St. Andrew constituency alone accounted for almost 35% of the political killings. The Eventide home fire on May 21st killed 153 elderly women. The Hannatown police station was attacked by gunmen. Ballot boxes were tampered with. Polling stations were not opened in targeted communities. The Jamaican Defense Force detained soldiers accused of plotting to overthrow the government. Manley's motorcade was attacked in Spanish Town. Sega's motorcade was attacked in Falmouth. When the votes were counted, the JLP won by 51 seats to 9, the largest electoral margin of victory in Jamaican history to that point. Edward Sega became the 5th Prime Minister of Jamaica. The peace that Massop and Marshall had organized, that Bob Marley had consecrated by raising 2 politicians' hands above his head in front of 32,000 witnesses, had been buried with its architects Into the vacuum Claude Massop left behind stepped Lester Lloyd Coke. He was known to Wes Kingston as Jim Brown, and he had been watching Massop operate since long before the peace concert, learning the structure, reading the power, understanding exactly where the leverage was. He had been employed as head of security at the Agro 21 agricultural complex operated under Sega's government, a facility that would later be identified in U.S. federal proceedings as a front connected to cocaine trafficking from Colombia. It was there, according to the Pambazuca academic record and the Kerry Senate Committee testimony, that Jim Brown built the expertise and connections he would need for what came next. The Shower Posse emerged around 1981, founded by Coke alongside Vivian Blake, operating out of the same Tivoli Gardens blocks that Massop had controlled. But the world had shifted beneath those blocks in ways that made everything Massop had built look like preparation for something else. Ronald Reagan had taken office in January 1981, and Sega had been the first world leader invited to the Reagan White House, the beginning of an alliance between Jamaica's JLP government and the American conservative establishment that would dramatically reorganize the political economy of the Caribbean. The cocaine trade routes that the CIA's Contra operations had created through the Caribbean were running at volume. The Shower Posse stepped directly into them. What Massop had operated was a political garrison, violent, dangerous, genuinely harmful to the communities it supposedly protected, but bounded by a local logic, enforce the JLP's control of West Kingston, deliver votes, maintain order, receive protection in return. What Jim Brown built was something categorically different. The Shower Posse became an international drug and firearms trafficking network with operations across Jamaica, the United States, Canada, and Europe. Where Massop had been a political instrument with a recognizable community identity, a man with a football club and a peace concert and 15,000 mourners, Jim Brown was a narco-entrepreneur operating inside the Cold War cocaine pipeline, accountable to no community and loyal to nothing but the economics of the trade. The Don era, with its codes of neighborhood obligation and its complicated, sometimes genuine investment in the welfare of the garrison community, was over. What replaced it was colder, more transnational, and more lethal than anything Massop had built or imagined. Jim Brown died in a prison fire in February 1992, under circumstances disputed enough to generate their own separate archive of conspiracy. His son Christopher Dudas Coke had already positioned himself to inherit what remained. In 2010, the Jamaican government's attempt to extradite Dudas to the United States triggered a military incursion into Tivoli Gardens that killed more than 70 people, civilians who had been living inside the garrison system that Saiga built, Massop enforced, and Jim Brown weaponized into something no peace concert could have addressed. The garrison was still there. The people were still there. Still dependent, still controlled, still used. The politicians were still there too, still benefiting, still insulated from the consequences of the system they had designed and maintained and defended and lied about for 50 years. What had changed was the nature of the power, the scale of the violence, and the complete disappearance of the idea that a man might one day, from inside the system, call a peace and mean it. That idea had died at the corner of Industrial Terrace and Marcus Garvey Drive, shot more than 40 times in a blue and white Morris Oxford on a February evening by officers who were later acquitted of murder in a court of law. The gun was never found, which raises the only question that matters, the one that 40 years of official silence has never answered and never needed to. If the peace was working, if the guns really were going down, if two men who had spent their lives enforcing a system of violence had genuinely decided to dismantle it, then who needed Claude Massop to have been holding a weapon that night? Was the truce already dead before the bullets were fired, or did it die because they were,